Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I think that if it hadn't have happened for me, then I'd be doing what you guys are doing on YouTube, because this is totally up my street. When I've got my most bravado and I'm strutting and I'm, you know, peacocking, is when I'm the most nervous and the most scared. There was tabloid newspapers were sending little green men, you know, journalists dressed as little green men to wait outside of my house. And it was, you know, Robbie Williams has gone mad and blah, blah, blah. And, I wasn't safe. There was a contract out on me to kill me. When I used to be on my bike, people used to try and run me over. I'd get bricks thrown at me, pint pots thrown at me. And I was a pub goer, and pubs became instantly unsafe for me.
Why?
Because of jealousy. Because of jealousy. You know, Young Bucks, Lord of the Flies. I'll tell you one story I don't think I've ever told. There was lots of times that I'd had to run for my life. But here I was in a gay bar in Manchester. The door opened to this different world that was just absolutely incredible. Fortunately, I didn't get to be a Keith Richards kind of character. My drug abuse, my alcohol abuse became very sad very, very quickly. I shot my emotions down, Sean, by probably taking your ecstasy.
What are we going to do about these hackers, Jen?
Have you not heard of Surfshark?
Yes, tell the viewers about Surfshark.
So Surfshark is an app and browser extension that you can get anywhere in the world.
Put your device anywhere in the world. So for example, if you want to watch all the stuff on American Netflix that is blocked in the UK, click on Surfshark, click on VPN USA, and there you've got it, access to all these shows early.
And stay safe on public Wi-Fi. So you can send and receive files safely. And you can get the best deals on online shopping. So yeah, I heard you can change your virtual location.
Which might come in handy with your window being smashed. But it also means if you go overseas, you can, through Surfshark, put in UK and access all your UK stuff. Jen, have you ever had FOMO?
Unfortunately, I have had a fear of missing out.
Turn on Surfshark and you will never have FOMO again. Click the link in the description box and you will get
85% off and 3 months free.
Get Surfshark VPN at surfshark.deals/Sean. Enter promo code SHAUN for 85% off and 3 months extra. Months three. Thank you for supporting our sponsor. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. Hey Rob, how's it going, man?
It goes good. How are you guys?
Fantastic.
Good. Right. Good to see you, Rob. We were just having a sing along.
Oh, what were you singing? It was Angels.
Oh, no.
The Flood.
We were singing The Flood.
Great.
Let me introduce you to Jen, my co-host.
Yeah. Hi, Robbie.
Hi, and how are you?
And Andrew has also, I think he's messaged you previously. He's with a co-host.
Hi, Rob. I got a message for you from, I was just talking to John Ronson, but he was just saying what a big fan of yours he is and what a nice person you are. And he said that whenever he's with you, wonderful and amazing things happen. Is that right?
I love John Ronson. Yeah. And whenever I'm with John Ronson, wonderful and amazing things happen. The last thing to happen with John Ronson was I'm very posh these days. So I took the children to the Beverly Hills Hotel for some breakfast, and John was in there and he joined us, and I ate up and I just walked off. And I'd left him to pay, and I didn't do it on purpose. So I owe John Ronson a breakfast, and apologies to John. It's not been forgotten. Are we straight in? Are we going straight in?
It is recording if you want to just keep going. Because before we get into your life story, then, what was it like searching for UFOs with John Ronson?
Well, what actually happened was, and this will be part of the life story, I guess, if that's what we're doing. In 2006, I'd retired from being a pop star. But I knew that I needed to do something. And I'd heard that if you get paid for your passion, you never work a day in your life. And that resonated with me. And I was like, well, what am I passionate about? And it was like, well, donuts and UFOs. And, you know, I couldn't be asked to make any donuts. So I had this thought where I'd become like Arthur C. Clarke back in the day when he had that television program. And I thought I would go and seek out weird and wonderful things. And John Ronson and me went to a UFO conference in Nevada. And it was my coming out as a tinfoil hat kind of person. And to be honest with you, I got so much of a kick in the press. There was tabloid newspapers were sending little green men, you know, journalists dressed as little green men to wait outside of my house. And it was, you know, Robbie Williams has gone mad and blah, blah, blah. And, I did put on 30 pounds and grew a beard, and I did look like a serial killer, so they might have had a point. But I found the whole episode so embarrassing and kind of degrading that I was like, okay, maybe I should turn to making donuts instead.
So can I please ask what your first experience with UFOs was?
My first proper experience goes back to the Beverly Hills Hotel once again. Wow. My first proper experience... Proper, other than, oh, that's interesting, could be a, I am with a young lady, and it's over 17 years ago, because I've been with my wife for 17 years, and it was, let's just say, an other, and we were on two hotel lounges in my room in the garden, looking up at the stars. And then all of a sudden, silently over our heads, what I can only describe, square object, I would say probably the size of 1.5 penalty boxes, to use a soccer or a football term. And it was matte black underneath. And it, I don't know if you remember Artexin from the 80s, Sean.
No.
Artexin, it was like what you add on your walls to try and make it look posh with all these swirls. They were like random swirls, Artexin. Yeah. And it was matte black with, you'll remember the Hacienda though.
Oh, yes.
Okay. So weirdly, it was matte black with the with this Artexin underneath, and then Hacienda style, yellow and black stripes, like it was a workman's thing. Do you understand what I'm saying? It was like, it was, I don't know. I just saw it. It came in silently, and I could have hit it with a tennis ball, and then it floated off. I was totally and utterly sober, which is something that I always tell people when I tell this story. I have been not sober a lot, and I've never seen anything like that. Quarter of the size of a football pitch, silently floating black, matte black objects. Yeah. And I saw it. I saw it. I witnessed it. I felt it. And then it floated off.
And what was going through your mind?
Oh, what was going through our mind was the same as the young lady who turned to me and went, "What the fuck?" You know? It was a giant "what the fuck" moment, and you know, I've sort of always had a passionate interest in that kind of stuff, and it sharpens the senses when you have your own Sightings. What I also thought was this. I didn't think little green men. I didn't think Zeta Reticula or Orion or interdimensional. I thought there's a bit of exotic technology that we're not supposed to have. And I felt in my spidey senses that it was our government, you know, our governments, the American government or whichever government. So, I didn't jump to little green men straight away. It's weird when you get into UFOs. I kind of came into UFOs with all manner of possibilities being true. You know, Zeta Reticuli, Orion, interdimensional time travelers, the Anunnaki, all of these things. And then the more you read, the less you know. And then you realize you should just go with what it is you absolutely 100% know for sure. And I know for sure I saw that. And I know that that exists.
It's something that we talk about quite a lot on Sean's show as well. And we love talking about all of that. And we also, you know, I know you're a person who's interested in spirituality. And as a famous person, I was wondering, have you been approached by Scientology ever?
I like the dark journalist. You have the dark journalist on.
He was on. Yeah.
Yeah. I really like him and the mystery schools and the Austrian... it's been a very, very long day for me. Steiner and the mystery schools and Hilda F. Klimt. There was this painter, right, in Sweden, and she's become instantly my favorite artist because she was just doing these portraits of, you know, cafe society and landscapes in Sweden. And then in 1903, she started getting these downloads from aliens and her art just completely changed. And if you go check it, Hilda F. Klimt, and just understand that this woman was painting these things in 1902, 1903, and it blew my mind. And I'm sure if you go and check it out, it may or may not blow your mind too. Have I been asked to join Scientology? Never.
Did you consider it?
No, because, you know, I've only heard and known about the supposed bad things attached to the church, alleged bad things attached to the church, you know, that seem quite strong, you know. So, no, it's never been something that's interested me to go and check out and do, but something in their works, and something in their works for a lot of people. And I always think that, you know, the best advert for Scientology is Kirstie Alley. Because if you watch her do any interviews, she doesn't sound insane, because everybody else that's attached to it, God bless them, you know, I love them and I'm a huge fan of all of those people. But it's like there's always something slightly off. But if they just sent Kirstie Alley in at the tip of their spear, I think they'd hit a lot more people like me.
So, Rob, what was it like growing up as a kid in the North? Was Stoke a bit like Widnes?
I'm guessing that Stoke was exactly like Widnes. And I love where I'm from. I love my people. I love my tribe. I love the sense of humor. I love the naughtiness, the cheekiness, the darkness of the humor too. And, you know, where I lived in a road of privately owned houses that ran in between two council estates. So what had happened with my mom, because my lineage is this, you know, down the pits, cannon fodder, probably worked in the bogs and the marshes in the dark ages. You know, we are from absolute poverty, absolute poverty. And my mum got a loan together and opened a ladies' dress shop in a, you know, not an upmarket area, let's say. And she made a success of it. And she was then able to open a coffee shop in a more salubrious area of Stoke-on-Trent. And then she bought upstairs and opened this ladies' dress shop, sold that, bought a flower shop, started selling flowers, and then opened a ladies' dress shop above that. And what she managed to do by herself as a single parent raising two kids was nothing short of miraculous. It's actually a bigger deal than anything that I've achieved. The hard slog, the ambition and the drive. And for everything that she did, she managed to take us from a council estate to a place where, I don't know, a teacher would live, or a, you know, or a dentist would live. How she did that is beyond me. And yeah, it is absolutely incredible. I'm in between two council estates on this one road. So I kind of like my peers instantly is like, I'm of them, but I'm not one of them. You know, there is that sort of distinction. Like, oh, he's got his own house, hasn't he? You know, it'd be like, there'd be the council houses, and well, he's from his own house, isn't he? They own that one.
Well, you do speak very highly of your mum. I mean, what was the relationship like with your dad?
The relationship with my dad was, I just adored him. He was my hero because he was a policeman. And then he went to this pub one night in Golden Hill in Stoke-on-Trent, and there was a talent competition. If you entered the talent competition and won, you won a fiver. And he was friends with some comedians who just nicked their jokes and told them and won the competition. And then the next week, he did another competition in Hanley in Stoke-on-Trent, and he won that too, and he made a tenner. And he made more money winning these competitions than he did being a policeman or wherever he was working at the time. He handed his notice in and went off to become a full-time entertainer. And in 1974, the year that I was born, he was on New Faces and won his round and got to the final and didn't win it. Now, my dad is incredibly charismatic, incredibly talented, and everybody absolutely loves him, including me. So I just grew up backstage. I grew up around cabaret. I grew up around show folk. And, you know, if my dad hadn't have left the police force, I'd have probably been a policeman.
Could you tell us the story of when you tried to buy your dad a house? But also I wanted to just ask, one of my favourite songs of yours is Knutsford City Limits. Is Knutsford a real place?
Is Knutsford a real place?
Yeah, I don't know. I just know you're from Stoke.
You don't know about Knutsford, Andrew.
I don't know about Knutsford. That's why I'm asking the question.
Okay, so Knutsford's really upmarket, actually. You know what? I sort of stretched an elastic band from Stoke-on-Trent to Mars with my career in general. But I also, with that song, stretched an elastic band from Knutsford to Mars because it was just a joke. Tina Turner had done a song called Nutbush City Limits. Right. It was like the worst pun ever that I strung into a whole song. But listen, I'm glad the song reached its destination.
I loved it. Yeah, and what was that? I wanted to know that story about when you tried to get your dad a house.
Oh, yeah. So my dad lived above a hairdresser's in Birch's Head in Stoke-on-Trent. And it was 50 quid a week, his house, his little flat. And it had those very, very steep stairs that like working class houses have. It's like, you know, two up, one down, whatever it is, stairs like this. And he's getting on a bit. And went into his flat one day and I went, Dad, why don't you just go out in Stoke, buy any house you want to? And he turned to me and he went, why? And I went, well, you know, you could have a garden. Headache. I'm all right here. Perfectly fine. And, you know, so that's the beauty of my father. It was that I was offering him to go and buy any house that he wanted. And he was just happy in himself and happy with his lot. I think that I'm a combination of my mum and my dad. I've got my mum's ambition and drive, and I've got my dad's ability to entertain. And I think that if my dad had had my mom's ambition, then he would have done exactly what I've done and achieved what I've done. But he just didn't. He's way happier than I've ever been. All of his life has just been, he's been in his own movie. It's like in his movie, he's Dean Martin living a charmed life, you know, putting 50p on the horses to last him all day for entertainment.
Did you know that you were always going to go into entertainment at that stage?
Well, I've got a 10-year-old daughter right now, Teddy, and I'm just watching what's happening to her. And all she wants to do is show off, you know, and I could probably put a positive spin on what it is that I do and what it is that she wants to do. I just always think that I'm doing, you know, interesting fannying about, but she's just fannying about just like a dad. And she always has, you know, from the moment that she could get somebody's attention, she wanted to be worthy of that attention and do something interesting for them. And I guess that's just how I was. The moment I could talk, I was singing. The moment I could walk, I was dancing. You know, it was what I was naturally inclined to do. And I was going to make a name of myself by hook or by crook. But whatever level that was going to be was in the lap of the gods. I couldn't have expected or even dreamt that I'd become me that's done this, you know. But, you know, to answer your question, I was always going to be in this sphere. I think that if it hadn't have happened for me, then I'd be doing what you guys are doing on YouTube, because this is totally up my street.
Were you popular in school, Rob, or were you like me getting beat up by the rugby players?
No, I wasn't unpopular. I hit on a good year in a good school, and, you know, there wasn't, I'm sure you could ask other people. I'm going to say blanket statement, there was no bullying. But other than, you know, the mean shit that you say when you're that age to each other, I wasn't unpopular. I wasn't academic at all. I've got ADHD. I've got dyslexia. I've got loads and loads of things. But those were the things that hampered me at school, and dyspraxia. And I left school with absolutely no qualifications at all. So if you ask any of my mates from school what they thought of me, they thought I was thick. Because in the 80s in Stoke-on-Trent, you didn't have dyslexia and you didn't have ADHD. So I just spent 5 years at school with a painted face, pretending that I was listening. And I think I did a really good job at fooling everybody, because I was quite good at acting. And also I did a good version of Butter Wouldn't Melt. So I got away with an awful lot of stuff too. I never got caught.
Do you still have mates from back in those days? And does that become hard with fame?
Yeah, instantly it does, because I auditioned for Take That when I was 15. I got in when I was 16. We became famous when I was just 17. And what happens is you get, especially with something like Take That, you get harnessed to a rocket ship that's going to Mars, and you're on the outside just holding on like this, and then you arrive in Mars and you go, how do I get back? Oh, you can't. Not only that, you know, that tribe you were part of, you are now no longer part of that tribe. You exist as an other outside of that, especially when you are 17, because young bucks are going to Lord of the Flies it. And it was like Lord of the Flies, you know. I wasn't safe. There was a contract out on me to kill me. When I used to be on my bike, people used to try and run me over. I'd get bricks thrown at me, pint pots thrown at me. And I was a pub goer, and pubs became instantly unsafe for me.
Why?
Because of jealousy. Because of jealousy, you know, young bucks, Lord of the Flies. I'll tell you one story I don't think I've ever told. There was lots of times that I'd had to run for my life, like loads of times. And there was this one time I was in a garage in Newcastle-under-Lyme, And I'd already known that I shouldn't be in these sort of places. I shouldn't be outside of my road and my pubs that I go to. But I'd had three pints and I was watching the football in a pub, and I went to a garage and stood in this garage, and there's about five people in front of me, and I see this car pull up. It's an old Talbot Sunbeam or something like that. And there's five lads in it. And I just knew I was fucked straight away. Five lads. And two of them got out. And I'm looking in the mirror behind the cashier. And I see one go to the other. It's Robbie. Come on. So they go and get the other three lads out of the car. And I look over to the exit. And I see the exit, green sign, exit. One of those push bar things, but it's got a chain on it and a padlock. And I'm thinking, if I run and get to that door, you're just going to kick my head in. So I'd had three pints. And when you've had three pints, you do think you're 10 men. And I got to the counter and I said, I'll have a pack of silk cut, a pack of prawn cocktail crisps, a lighter and some lighter fluid. And I turned around and I knocked the cap off the lighter fluid and lit the flame on the lighter and just did that through all five of them and then got outside and ran off.
Oh my God. It's like the video from No Regrets.
Yeah. But those sort of things happened. Those sort of things happened an awful lot, wow. You know. On a regular basis. What then would happen too is outside my mum's house, there'd be anything from 20 to 50 girls. One day the police had to cordon off the road because there were so many girls outside the house, and they would jump over and rip grass up and steal wood off the fence and jump over the back and like nick the washing off the washing line. And then every Thursday, a coach full of 50 would arrive from Germany, and they do like take that houses travel, and they'd like go to mine, and then 50 would jump out and then take photos and rip up daffodils and shit, and then get back on a tour bus and then go to Mark's house and do it there, and Howard's house and do it there. So, you know, there was the contract army to kill me. There was the no safety anywhere that I went. I felt vulnerable to attack at any moment I was outside of the house. Then when I was inside of the house, I was the man of the house, and I had to protect my mum and my sister. Yeah, so I acquired a few things that I slept with that probably would have got me 5 years if they'd have found out that I had acquired those things that I was sleeping with. And then, so mum closed the curtains because, you know, there would just be girls doing that in the front window. My mum sort of working all the hours that God sends to provide a, not even a lower class, lower middle class. It wasn't, you know, I think the aspirations were to be lower middle class, but we didn't quite achieve that, you know. So that on top of this stuff that was happening to me and what was happening in our neighborhood, the cars would get broken into every week. And, you know, she became quite depressed with it. And then my life at work was spent with what I thought was going to happen with Take That was we were going to be this gang, and it was going to be like school, because school to me, I've never laughed so much as I did that when I was at school. You know, that was the best thing for me, was the socializing and the belly aches of laughter. And I thought that that was what was going to be being in Take That. And then we were going to be in Take That. It's going to be the best gang. And we're going to be famous. That's amazing, right? So what actually happened was I joined Take That. Gary Barlow is already a musical genius, right? He's already making more money than his teachers at the age of 13 because he's working clubs every night. Hmm. He wrote a million love songs when he was, I think he was 13 when he wrote a million love songs.
Christ.
13 or 14. So Nigel Martin-Smith, our manager, took him and then put us four Muppets around him. So Gaz instantly in his head is going, what are these four Muppets for? You know, so if I'm guessing what happened, he's already resentful that he has to take us along for the ride. And you've got Jason Orange, that's one of five brothers that was always fighting for his position in his own family. And then he's put in another family where he's fighting position and jostling. And then you've got Howard, that's really lovely and really funny, but doesn't say an awful lot. And then you've got Mark Owen, that's like a beautiful, wonderful soul that I palled up with. But we weren't a gang, you know, we weren't. We are now, funnily enough. But those early years were, you know, I have my problems with how we were managed at the time that I can't go into because, you know, he's very litigious. So what happened was I didn't feel safe and comfortable at work, and I wasn't actually physically safe at home. And
with Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
That was a toxic powder keg for somebody in their formative years. That it's like sending a 10-year-old to the gym to bench press and, you know, work with dumbbells and kettlebells. You wouldn't send a 10-year-old to do that. As a 16, 17-year-old, you're on this rocket ship to Mars. You become incredibly famous. It's toxic.
I was listening to Sporty Spice today. She just did a long-form podcast, and she said she went from just being a young person out of Widnes to within 2 years being internationally famous. And you described, you know, this meteoric feeling. She said to survive it, she said it was the best and worst time of her life, and to survive it, she had to completely shut her emotions down. Did you have to shut your emotions down?
I shut my emotions down, Sean, by probably taking your ecstasy.
Shelley's.
Shelley's laser. Did you go to Shelley's laser dome?
I was always in Shelley's, man. Shelley's, the Eclipse in Coventry.
We were probably in Shelley's.
Were you there when Evolution played there? The night Evolution played, take me higher.
Alternate played in the car park one night. I saw the Prodigy there.
Wow.
Yeah. I began self-medicating at a very, very early age. My daughter's 6 years away from being 16. And as a 16-year-old, I'm doing trips in Shelley's. You know, it's like, what the... And also, without social media, I was in this Lily White pop group, but I was getting away with so much. Did you ever go to Money Pennies?
I didn't go to Money Pennies, no.
I was in Money Pennies doing a lot of things. I was in Cream doing a lot of things. I was in the Hacienda doing a lot of things. Yeah, I managed to get away with singing a million love songs by day and then, you know, taking a million pills by night.
So was that a refuge from the danger of the pubs?
Well, see, we'd go mob handed, like with Shelley's. That was before I was famous. But everywhere else that I went, you know, I hooked up with a crew from Warrington, and the, you know, they were all sort of like that. And we'd be mob handed. I was safe with them because there was enough of us and the music was great. And I didn't have to put my steel toe cap boots on for fear of getting my head kicked in. And that's how I used to grade where I was going to in Stoke-on-Trent. It'd be like, I'm going Valentino's on student night tonight. I better put my steel toe cap boots on. And now I can just go in my, you know, Adidas Gazelles or whatever and enjoy myself. But this did happen. This one thing did happen. So we got our first gig there. And we didn't have a dressing room. It was just an alcove with some curtains. Then we only did gay clubs, I'd say, for the next 14 months.
How far was it along until you split?
We were very restricted and there was lots of different rules. And you can't do this, you can't be that, and you can't have a girlfriend and blah, 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 blah. My place in the band was always being threatened, you know, that with not being in the band, we can always find a boy with brown hair from Stoke-on-Trent and call him Robbie and you can be replaced and all of that business. Once we'd cemented ourselves with two albums and multi-platinums and playing arenas night after night, I was like, ding, no one can fire me. I'm going out. I did this big, I broke the rules by going to Glastonbury, which was kind of, it was seismic for me and kind of seismic for everybody else that had this boy bander that hadn't got his indie stripes wandering around backstage. I wasn't allowed to go. Imagine not being allowed to go. I took off with a boot full of champagne and a pocket full of cocaine. So would start my new life. After that, I think it became apparent that I couldn't be cajoled or restricted or play the game. And it wasn't long after that that, you know, I said I wanted to leave after this particular tour. The boys took that as an opportunity to say, we'd like you to leave now. What do you think? And I upped and left.
So who was playing at Glastonbury?
Oasis and Paul. M People
were on.
Did
you look up to those guys at that time? Did you want to be more like the sort of a solo artist that you came to be, or indie?
Yeah, I don't think that anybody really, when they're 16, 17, 18 or 19, musically aspires to the music that boy bands are making. You know, there is a pretense that can be formed when you are that age that sort of goes, I'm not into that, I'm into this. But I was actually being paid to be into that. And everybody that I loved and liked and respected and wanted to be like played guitar music. And I was no different to any, any boy that was buying the Enemy magazine or Melody Maker magazine or The Face or Select or whatever it was. You know, I wanted to be like that. It felt like more fun and it felt real, you know. I've double tripled back on that as I've got older and, you know, my pretenses have fallen away. And, you know, I can love a New Kids on the Block song the same way as I can dig a Radiohead song and, you know, so and so forth. You know, I don't have those pretenses anymore. But yeah, I saw Oasis in a video. First time I really saw them was a track called Whatever. Free to do whatever I.
Yeah.
It was dangerous, you know, and it was menacing and it was cool and it was laddie. And a big gig of mine when I was growing up, there was three gigs that I had on VHS. One of them was Public Enemy at Brixton, I think, or Shepherd's Bush Empire, I'm not sure what. Prince's Love Sexy Tour. and the Happy Mondays at the GMEX. And there was, with the Happy Mondays, there was this sort of naughtiness that I so desperately wanted to be part of. It felt like my tribe and they felt like my people. And that's what I wanted to be. But there I was on Top of the Pops singing a million love songs later and here I am. You bet your life that when Common People came out, or Boys and Girls by Blur, or whatever by Oasis, that's what I wanted to do. That's who I wanted to be.
So I tell the school kids that drugs start out fun at first, but it leads to dark and dangerous places. And for example, you know, Russell Brand, I've read his books, and he went some really dangerous places, got arrested a few times. How about yourself, Rob? Did it take you to some dark and dangerous places?
I got arrested in my mind. You know, my mind went to hell and my psychosis did. And it happened quite quickly. Unfortunately, the golden era of using for me dried up very, very quickly. You know, I suppose I had 18 months worth of fantastic times, paying for it on the Tuesday after a Saturday. You know, those Tuesdays that you used to get where you were, I suppose you'd used up all of your serotonin and your mind's crying out for help and all you can do is lay vulnerable on the sofa. But I was yet to find my place properly in Hades, and that quickly came. That quickly came through finding out that you can keep the party going after the ecstasy by doing cocaine. Cocaine's a hell of a drug, and it took me to hell very, very quickly. Unfortunately, I didn't get to be a Keith Richards kind of character. My drug abuse, my alcohol abuse became very sad very, very quickly. And I knew that there was something wrong with me that I'd labeled in my head, oh, I think I'm an alcoholic. By the time I was 19, when you talk about it, it's still sort of in my mind, the nostalgia of what it was to be around that sort of rave culture and what we all thought we were achieving and where we all thought we were going, and these mind cosmonauts that were going to change the planet by dancing. You know, we all thought we were onto something. I don't know. I just think by sweating profusely in a club and dancing like that, we thought we were going to change the world. But our world did change. You know, my world changed. I am glad I experienced that. I still to this day pay for those moments in one way or another.
What was your stopping point?
Well, I'm an addict and I'm an alcoholic. And addicts like to addict. There is a bit of me that's quite smart, and I will try and find any loophole that I can find. And I mean, like, okay, so tried heroin, that didn't work. Cocaine's bad. What about pills? I'll just take pills. I'll take like a doctor's pills, and then you get addicted to them. I can't sleep. I'll take sleeping pills. And then I end up sort of with 15 sleeping pills in my pocket, nibbling them on a night out. That's kind of what happens to me. And then you go, okay, I've tried all of these things. What about weed? Weed, I could still have my career and I wouldn't lose everything. I still turn up to everything. But then weed just gave me complete psychosis. And then you sort of like, you give NyQuil a go. You know, it's just like loophole after loophole after loophole after loophole, looking to be able to switch Radio Rob off, numb it, and just have a holiday from your own mind without going to prison, without going to hell, without losing your family and losing your career. I've knocked out all of those loopholes. I haven't had a drink for 22 years. I had a brief period where I was doing cocaine without drinking, which was absolutely friggin' horrible. That lasted for a few months. I'm pleased to say that, I'm a sober guy. Something's always lurking around the corner, though. And I still can't be trusted with pills. The wife has to put them behind lock and key. Because what happens with me is I'll find that, you know, there'll be some sort of pills that are somewhere for a medical procedure or whatever. And they'll just be there, and they could be there for 18 months, every single day. Vicodin, whatever. Every day, see them, go to bed. Da-da. One day, for no reason, not being sad or not being happy or not feeling vulnerable, just whatever is in the air that day, all of those pills go. If you can channel this energy correctly, you can be an X-Man, you know. So I'm currently addicted to drawing, and I'm addicted to making these funny cartoons. Well, I think they're funny. And I've got like 600 of them, 700 of them. And then I turned my hand to doing art, and I had my first exhibition at Sotheby's. And I've written this TV show. There's a dark comedy, come up with this idea for a talent show that's sort of never been seen before in a different way. Got these three drinks coming out. I've got a clothes company coming out. So this all comes from the addictive gene. The reason why, you know, I've had 15 of my own albums, 15 released albums, 3 online, 5 with Take That. There's 100 songs on my computer that nobody's ever heard, that's sort of like the vault. This is all the addictive nature.
When we wake up in the morning, we get out of bed and we start our day with Koro Snacks. Koro is a healthy snacks brand focusing on bringing additive-free natural ingredients to the customers with fair prices in bulk packaging. They have everything from nut butters to free from baking ingredients to cooking essentials and, of course, the snacks. And the energy balls are delicious.
Oh, they're my favourite, the salted pistachio.
Ooh.
I can't wait to have this this morning.
Let's see what this one tastes like.
Cheers.
Cheers. So what makes Koro special in comparison to others? Their bulk packaging allow them to offer their customers high-quality products at a fair price. For a 5% discount on Koro's products, use the code TRUECRIME, with no space in between true and crime. The link to Koro's online shop is in the description box on YouTube. Thanks for supporting our sponsor.
If I can channel it that way, I can do great things with it. And it's just that, you know, I find that sitting with a Posca paint pen and drawing stuff turns this off. So, you know, that's not a bad loophole to have. And my wife allows me a lot of leeway. She allows me to spend 8 hours just doing that, you know, because she knows that I'm an addict. And if I'm doing that, I'm not doing the other. Like, for example, I start walking and I've got an iWatch. And I do 25,000 steps a day. 25,000 steps a day because I get addicted to walking. I played golf. I'd wake up. I'd go to the driving range. I'd hit 200 balls. Then I play 36 holes every day. And sugar's a bitch because sugar's more difficult than booze, and sugar's more difficult than cocaine. And it's got me. It's got me in the grips of its power. I suppose what I'm trying to say is, at the minute, I'm a very sober man that thinks and behaves addictively. But the way that I behave these days addictively isn't going to get me divorced, isn't going to make me lose my job. And in fact, I'm adding more to my life because of my predilection to wanting too much all of the time.
But somebody with an addictive personality, can you try and help us understand what it might be to be out, let's say, at Nebworth in front of hundreds of thousands of people? I think it set a record at the time to feel that rush. And is that addictive as well.
I explain Nebworth. So I've always had charlatan syndrome, and to this day I still have it, but it's not as overwhelming as it used to be. Like the and I have intrusive thoughts, and my intrusive thoughts have a jujitsu style grip over me, feeding myself anything positive about myself. It's very difficult to understand, but in the early days of my solo career, I didn't believe that I deserved any of it. And no matter how big, from the first university that I did my gig at, first gig at, to the arena, to then the stadium, to then Nebworth, I didn't feel as though I deserved any of it. And the bigger it got, the bigger this charlatan syndrome got too. And weirdly, when I perform, when I've got my most bravado and I'm strutting and I'm, you know, peacocking, is when I'm the most nervous and the most scared. Nebworth was a time for me where the intense responsibility of facilitating a good time for these good people that had spent good money to come to see me was overwhelming. If you don't think you deserve it, and there is 135,000 people turning up, the person that is backstage is very, very different to the person that is on stage. It just felt like the world was collapsing in on me, and I was trying to lift this amorphous blob of self-hatred to mix and match it with this adoration that I was receiving at the front. You know, it was completely and utterly unhealthy and unsustainable. You know, that's intrusive thoughts that are very powerful and very negative.
Bit of an introvert then, as opposed to an extrovert.
Yeah, I'm absolutely an introvert, you know, I want to isolate, and it takes me an awful lot. I'm better than I used to be. When I first started going out with my wife, all of her friends thought I didn't exist, because like she'd be going and having meals with people in the evening and it'd just be her. Because like, and then I'd sort of get a free pass. It's like, well, Robbie's that guy that doesn't come out. And what happened was, when the kids arrived, they kind of smoked me out of the house. I had to go and join in with the world. And slowly, I've got better at it. By nature, my very being would be, I'd have my head on the pillow and my eyes would open in the morning, and then I'd just stay there all day, because that's what I want to do. That's where I feel the most comfortable. That's where I feel the most safe, you know. But my dad's the same. You know, that story I told you about his flat and not why. You know, I'm kind of the same. It's like, do you want to go out? Why? I've been out. I want to do it again. You know, I've been out. I've been out a lot. I've seen it. It's got nothing to offer me. And then when you sort of get sober, I realize that, oh, I'm a massive introvert that was actually using cocaine as a tool to be able to socialize. All of that is taken away. And then I didn't know how to speak to people. I didn't know how to conversate. Yeah, I used to have a friend that was sort of like my talking head that I'd go everywhere with, and he'd do the talking for me, and I'd be just feeling uncomfortable in my skin behind him. But it is definitely socializing for me was at the beginning, like going to the gym. And when you go to the gym first time and you lift those big weights and you get that pain down here, lactic acid buildup. And socializing felt like lactic acid buildup. And I think, I'm not going to do that again. But then you have to do it. You have to keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it. And unfortunately, it takes way longer to become more natural than I would like it to be. Still to this day, you know, socializing, I find overwhelming and takes my energy instead of gives it to me. But I do it and I am better at it. The fact that I'm doing this podcast with you and I can say all of these words out of my mouth means that something has changed for me.
So, Rob, I tried heroin once. It was in America. A girlfriend had just dumped me. I was brokenhearted. She invited me over. She had some heroin. I thought if I did it with her, we were going to get back together, which never happened. But anyhow, she shot me up. I was floored right away. And for 2 days, I was just hallucinating, puking, scratching my balls. And it put me off ever wanting to do that for the rest of my life. You said earlier that you tried it and it didn't work for you. Did you experience something similar?
I was in King's Cross and I was at somebody's flat, the great and good at the time. And the cocaine ran out, but the heroin hadn't. And it was as simple as that. You know, it was as simple as, yeah, go on then, you know, because heroin's bad, right? And what happened for me was I just was throwing up. I wasn't hallucinating. I wasn't scratching anything, but I was just throwing up and it felt awful. It felt terrible. And I'd heard that doing heroin was like God giving you a cuddle. And like the people that I was with were like, what do you think? And I was like, it's like God giving me a cuddle, but it wasn't at all. It just felt disgusting and poisonous and vile. And I didn't run back to do it again.
I wonder if we should get onto the music, because you've just released this brilliant re-record of all your greatest hits. I was just at this wedding the other day where the musicians went from table to table playing, you know, people had to request hits and they requested, you know, all the big, you know, ironic Alanis Morissette and things like that. And everyone was having a good time. And then someone requested Angels and the place just went berserk. Like all the grandparents, the dads, the kids, everyone's getting up and singing along. It was mad. And you know, how does Angels feel to you today looking back? That song, how did that change things? And do you ever feel like it's your Creep, like Radiohead? Because I know they get tired of playing Creep, I think.
I don't think they get tired of playing Creep. They just don't play it. I think they hate it. And it's not the same with me and Angels. I'm very, very grateful for it. Like I said, I've got 100 unreleased songs that I've written that are on my computer. I've written 15 albums that have been released. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of songs I've written. I've had the chance to replicate the same thing that Angels has done every time I sit down and think up some words and think up a melody, and I never have. You know, that song exists somewhere outside of me, in a different realm. And that song gave me absolutely everything that I have today. I'm never sick of singing it. I don't understand what it does to people. I just know that it does. And I don't have to understand it. You know, it's the same in loads and loads of countries too. You know, it exists somewhere outside of me. Never bored of singing it. And also it signifies that it's the end of my show too, because start with Let Me Entertain You, finish with Angels. So every time I'm singing Angels, I'm quite relieved that I facilitated what I need to facilitate and I'm going home next.
Would you say that's one of your favorite songs you've performed?
As I'm getting older, I just like any ballads that work. So I don't have to do much work then. You know, you're doing Rock DJ and you're doing Let Me Entertain You and, you know, all of these sort of high octane testosterone filled songs, and my body's just not up for it. So I'd much prefer just like, you know, a string quartet, an acoustic guitar, and sing She's the One, Angels, and Feel.
You said that you and your bandmates, you thought they were going to be a, you know, a gang tight, and it wasn't that way, even though it's become that now. Did you guys fall out at some point then, and what was that over?
We never fell in. You know, we were of this thing that was happening to us, and there was a love there, but we were strangers. You know, we were strangers foisted into this happening. And you know, I didn't like how we were treated when we were in the band. And it felt like there was only one person being managed, and that was Gary Barlow. It's like Gary Barlow and the four backing dancers. And I had ambitions and hopes and dreams. You know, what happened within that setup was very much felt like we were second-class citizens. And that leads to resentment, and it leads to jealousy. And, you know, all of those things. And then when I left Take That, it was the 90s and it was heady and it was people attacking people in print and it was the dumb thing and it was interesting, you know. So I, fueled by cocaine and alcohol and resentment, I attacked them at every opportunity that I could. And testament to them, because of the people that they are, they never attacked me back. But I wanted that back and forth. It just never came. Gary Barlow's just a very nice man. You know, he's just a very nice man.
Did you have any crazy beefs with other celebrities who did attack back?
Oasis throughout the years. Yeah, that's, you know, I've offered to fight Liam Gallagher a couple of times. And
like, yeah, fist fight him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I spoke to Barry Hearn. Which one's the son? A boxing promoter. And I wanted to properly, because I'd seen these YouTubers boxing. Eddie Hearn. Yeah. I'd seen these YouTubers boxing and I thought, I'd like to test myself and do that. But there's only one person that I wanted to fight. And that was Liam, but he wouldn't fight me. That being said, just to wrap up that, because I don't want that to start up all over again. Look, Liam Gallagher, please, for him, that everything's going really well for him. And, you know, he's an incredible rock star, an incredible personality, and the world is richer for him being in it. So I'll just qualify that with that. Yeah, that was probably the only public beefs. Yeah.
Are you mates now then with the Gallaghers?
No, I don't know them. I don't know them. They don't.
Do you listen to his music?
I do. Yeah, I do. Yeah. I like Liam's music. Last album, there's like five or six songs on it that are just absolutely incredible. You know, that they're, because, you know, I'm really competitive. And I want to know what people are doing, and I want to know what the people around me from my time in the sun in every way are up to, and how it's going for them, and where I should be in the pecking order of things. And, you know, I see it very much as a...
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
A sport. I suppose there's the ethereal stuff when you sit down and cast your net out and try to create these beautiful pop songs that might mean somebody to someone, might cuddle them, or, you know, might soothe them. And then there's these other songs that I do are full of bravado. But then after that, you know, it's a battle. I want to win. I always want to win.
You know, when they ask, like, Harry Kane, like, were you aware of that record you've just got or whatever? And it'll always be like, oh, I wasn't aware of that. I mean, were you aware of the latest album that's now, I think, the most solo album number ones in the UK history?
Yeah. I and we, my team, achieved it. And what actually happens is you get to exhale, because it's very important for me that I get to have my creative endeavors met positively. And for my creative endeavors to be met positively, I have to have some form of relevancy. And my form of relevancy in this particular week has come by having another number one album that is beaten or equaled Elvis. And, you know, it bodes well, because I'm very vulnerable and I'm very fragile. And you take away you take away relevancy from Robbie Williams's life. Who and what am I? You know, that leaves me scared. I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to have to find out. There's no sense of pride and of puffing out of the chest. It's just a relief that I'm still somebody.
Have you ever had to box any paparazzi? What's the lens they've gone to get close to you?
No. I mean, I used to be followed by them 24/7, and I was too smart to hit one of them, because it would have cost me money. Although I wanted to. You know, they are sociopaths of the highest order that cannot hear you and will not hear you and have no empathy. And they are the sort of flying monkeys of the Witch of the West, and they feed off trauma. Trauma takes a shit, and they come searching through that shit, trying to find out how they can salvage and make money from it.
I just find that a really bizarre job. I've always found that a bizarre job. The idea of ever even interviewing someone who doesn't want to be interviewed by me, let alone sticking a camera in their face, getting into their lives and things.
You have empathy.
A little bit.
A little bit, but you have more than them, which is quite easy to achieve. But you understand that wouldn't be a nice thing to do, or a human thing to do. To behave in that way, but they don't have that human instinct. They have something else that gives them the ability to behave in that way.
It's bizarre. It is bizarre. What is that part of why you quit in 2006? Was it the attention, paparazzi, and all that?
That was a lot to do with it. Yeah, that was a lot to do with it. I set about dismantling and sabotaging my career. Because the spotlight that shone on me at the time, I found too intense. And what happened was, 2006, I was just like, do you know what? I know how I win this, because me being competitive again, I just sit on this sofa and I never leave. And that's what I'm going to do. So I bought this cashmere caftan that I got in Morocco, and I grew a beard. I looked like a serial killer. And I ate honey Dijon kettle chips for dinner and watched The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills and didn't move for 3 years. And by the time I came out in like 2009, I came out the house, they'd all gone. And I was like, fellas, lads. So what I set out to achieve, I actually did. And the spotlight moved on to other people. And there is a lot of me that is very grateful to have passed me for having done that. But then there's a lot of me too that's still full of ego and wanted to be the king of the world.
So had you seen Sean's channel before you came on? Did you know much about it?
Yeah.
Rob's into conspiracies, aren't you?
That's my jam. Look, you know, I've seen things that shouldn't exist. Therefore, everything's on the table. And I do believe that I have an open mind. Time and research and experience has led me to not having my mind so open that it falls out. You know, there's that saying, that phrase. Everything's on the table, but I believe nothing. I just look at things and go, that's interesting, you know, and that may be the case. But, you know, I I don't run away thinking I've got the answers just because I did some research by watching some YouTube videos, which a lot of people do. They sort of, you know, they sort of get carried away with the what is and what isn't happening in the world. And that, you know, somebody that's behind the scenes, I want to go, no, that's not happening. It's not happening. So wake up, some of it is, but that isn't. I can tell you that isn't. But it's not my place. It's not my place to let people know either way. And then I had a thought the other day, was like, hey, what if it, all of this is chaos? It's just chaos. And that fucking terrified me, that there's no conspiracies and it's just chaos. I'd rather have the conspiracies than I would have it just be chaos. Because if you sit with the fact that it is chaos for long enough, it's actually paralyzing.
Have you met David Icke or read his books?
I have met David Icke and I did read his books. And there used to be this bookstore in Los Angeles called the Bodie Tree. And it was just the best store ever. It was like, you know, when Harry Potter goes and gets his wand in that he walks through that alleyway and then he ends up in this menagerie of places that sell all sorts of potions and owls and stuff. It was like wandering into one of those stores. And I was sure that the secrets of the universe existed in one, if not 100 of these books. So I bought them all. And one of them was David Icke. And I found that all fascinating. And then, you know, I always find it fascinating when I find out where his research for things comes from. It's like, oh, he's got that from there and he's got that from there. He's made that, you know, the reptilian agenda and all of that business, whatever, that sits. If you take that out of the equation, there's some very interesting nuggets there that may or may not be happening. And like I said before, that doesn't necessarily mean that I believe in anything. I don't. I'm just a naive scholar that's trying to figure out whether there's magic or not.
I think you've hit on something really interesting there, because I was just interviewing a skeptic called Michael Shermer the other day, and he said exactly what you just said before, which is one of the reasons so many of us like to believe in conspiracy theories is because the alternative that there's no one in charge, nobody knows what they're doing, we're all just sort of bumping around, is terrifying.
It would appear that we are closer to everybody just bumping around than this whole magic tapestry that people like me have found themselves learning about since the internet existed. I can point to it being bumbling idiots more than I can point to it being reptiles.
Yeah.
There's more evidence that it's bumbling idiots.
Yeah, I think so. There's one thing I picked up on that you said a few years ago, which is that you'd love to be famous in the US so that Jennifer Aniston knows who you are. And I just wonder, does Jennifer Aniston know who you are? And is it not a relief for someone as famous as you and, you know, all around the world to have somewhere where you can walk around and not be as mobbed?
Yeah, I said that an awful long time ago. That was before the wife. what happened was, I was promoting an album in the States. I think it may have been my first or second album. And, you know, were you dealing with somebody that's mentally ill? I had severe anxiety, severe depression. I couldn't find any joy in anything. And it would seem that the job that I'd chosen was quite toxic and was exasperating all of these ailments. And I got to the States and I was like in a radio station in Milwaukee or wherever it was. And I sort of had an epiphany and I'm like, I've just sold 7 million albums. I've got several million in the bank. What? Why do I want more of this? It's just going to make things worse. And I stopped working in the States straight away and bought a house there. And I've never done any work in the States ever since. Oh, and I get to be Bruce Wayne in Beverly Hills and I get to be Batman in the rest of the world. And it's saved me. It's given me the space to be able to be a human. And it's another one of those decisions made, though, where there is the grown up that's driving the car that thanks me for doing that. And then there's the egomaniac in the back who's going, yeah, but, you know, if you'd have done that, then you could have had this, that and the other, and you could be this. And, you know, Rocky would know who you are. What the fuck does any of that mean, though? You know?
Do you think it was because your name's so close to Robin Williams? Do you think that's an issue?
What, with not breaking the states? No, I bumped into him once. Well, I say bumped into him. He was in the same plaza where I was shopping, and I did want to go over to him and go, do you ever get there? Because I get there. And I didn't. There's been a couple of times when I turned up at restaurants in LA where they've thought Robin Williams was coming, and then they get me and they're disappointed.
Does money just become a number, Rob? I mean, once you can go certain restaurants and you can travel the world and you can buy whatever house you want, does the rest just become a number after that?
No, that's the trick about money that I don't think many people know. You're always on the gerbil wheel. You're always on the gerbil wheel. And the more money you get, the more you spend, and the bigger toys you have, and the more expansive your life becomes, and the more people that you employ, you know, you become terrified to give any of it up because it makes your life easier. What happens is you get a penchant and a taste for the finer things in life, and they're all ridiculously expensive. I've got friends that are billionaires, and on the quiet, I'll just go, do you ever have financial insecurity? And they'll all go, to a man and a woman, yes. Yes, wow. I do. Every day, all day. That's the big secret. There's a big secret, because it doesn't matter who you are or how much you've got, you're always scared of losing it, or you're always scared of abusing it. And you're never sure where what is going and to who. And how long this will last. If I get this thing and I go on that thing and I eat this thing and I wear this thing, and, you know, it's, I have financial insecurity, and, it's a bizarre thing to express, but I do ask the people that are above me in a different stratosphere, and they have it, you know, so. That's the big secret.
So does making it become an addiction?
No, because I'm never thinking about the paycheck. I'm never thinking, you know, it becomes something that happens afterwards. And I go, oh, cool. That's amazing. Great. I can facilitate our lifestyle. But it's all to do with not wanting to let me down, not wanting to let my audience down, no matter what it is that I do. You know, I'm there to facilitate a good time for them. I'm not there to be entertained. They're there to be entertained. And money is a secondary. But, you know, you have to have a purpose and you have to have a reason to go to work. And since I've seen my job and my life as work, everything makes sense. When daddy leaves the house, daddy goes to work. And my four children have given me immense purpose and immense drive. As I've said before, my family were cannon fodder, and they were pit workers and bog marchers and, you know, canal diggers. And, you know, my grandma's school report said she will be fit to work for the people over her. That's all she was going to do. She's going to leave school and work under somebody. And that's one person ago. And I'm me that's done what I've done. I want to see how far that I can take this. You know, it's like, I want to see how far this can go and what I can create. Driving force behind that is my family and my family's family and my family's family family. And also the driving force behind that is creativity and a drive to be a success with what I'm creating. It gives me purpose. But the check isn't the driving force. Cristiano Ronaldo, when he gets on the football field, isn't thinking about his 500 grand a week. He's thinking about his purpose and what he needs to do and how he needs to achieve greatness. In whatever forum I am in whatever meager talents I have, I'm trying to at least achieve greatness. And if money comes because of that, then great.
How have you adapted the crazy life into your family life? Because you are quite the family man these days.
It's only crazy when I go to work, you know, and my life consists of doing nothing for several months and then everything for a short period of time and then nothing again for several months. So, you know, I'm just daddy. I'm Bruce Wayne, you know. And then I get exhausted because work tends to demand an awful lot of me for a very short period of time. So, you know, I could be a better father during these moments, but I only have enough energy to promote the album and to do the show. The two do mix well. You know, I'm in a monogamous relationship with my wife. I'm a good boy. I want to be a good father and role model to my children, and I want to provide for them the most amazing life. We're doing well. Every day's a school day. You know, the kids need to see me, so they're homeschooled right now. The wife thinks that they should have a high school experience. I don't think so at all. I just want them with me at all times. They make everything for me make sense. And I'm in love. I'm totally in love.
This is a question that I suppose I could ask anyone with your level of fame. Let's say you and the family want to go away to like Paris or something. You want to go to Disneyland. What do you do? Because if you do that, you're just going to be mobbed. You can't just go on EasyJet, surely. I don't think there's like posher planes that go to like local destinations. So what do you do?
We were in Disneyland 2 weeks ago.
Oh, well, fair enough.
Yeah, we were in Paris. And COVID masks were an absolute treat.
I was going to say, did you wear a disguise?
Yeah, those masks in COVID have just made more things possible than ever were before. So, you know, we went to Disneyland in Paris on a very, very busy weekend. We stayed at the hotel there at Disneyland, had the most incredible time, created some incredible memories as a family. And I had my cap on and I had my sunglasses on and I had a COVID mask. And, you know, out of 8,000 people that were there, maybe two people recognized who I was.
Wow. Did you fly EasyJet or Ryanair or something?
we were actually already in Paris. So I was, we'd been there for quite some time. The wife thinks she's French and she absolutely adores Paris. So we spend a lot of time there.
Hope you're enjoying the podcast. Here's a word from our sponsor, Harry's. Having such a scratchy face, I'm always delighted to get a new Harry's set. There's a foaming gel, hydrating night lotion, and the razor with the weighted handle really gets the job done. The trimmer blade makes it so easy to get into those tricky places to reach. The shave gel offers effective lubrication and just comes off like butter. It's such a smooth shave. It shaves fast, efficiently, no discomfort, and it is so smooth by the end. The hydrating night lotion is light and non-greasy. Harry's is doing a £0 trial. Start shaving with the products, just pay for delivery. Save every time. Save on all your shaving products without sacrificing quality. You're in control. You can modify or cancel your plan from the account page. Make sure to support our podcast and start your own skincare journey by redeeming a free Harry's trial set. All you cover is £3.95 for delivery. Just head to harrys.com/Sean, S-H-A-U-N, and have your trial set delivered to your door. That's harrys.com/Sean, S-H-A-U-N. Thank you for supporting our sponsor. What do your parents make of your meteoric rise? And did their lives change as well as the money came in?
I think it's very complicated for them. Complicated and wonderful and weird, because on a very basic level, my mum, whose job it is to nurture, was dealing with an alcoholic son. and an addict son. So, you know, whether that person is famous or not, that's all that they're dealing with. And that was her and my story from 17 until 26, 25. My dad wears it very, very well. You know, he loves it and he's incredibly proud of me. He's also been on tour with me and done every single show with me for the last 15 years.
Wow.
Comes on and sings with me. But unfortunately, he's got Parkinson's now and he's nearly homebound, so he can't come do that anymore. Yeah, I think that my dad loves it and my mum's found it difficult to deal with.
And there was that, I mean, I think it was misunderstood when you said, "I'm rich beyond my wildest dreams," it became this big famous thing. But I gather that was a joke that was misunderstood, right?
Yeah, what happened was, actually what was happening in my mind was, I'm this charlatan that's taken up a space in the music industry just by sheer fluke of being auditioning for a boy band and getting in. And now I'm being given the biggest record contract in the history of music. I think what does a person behave like and perform like that's being paid 80 million? You know, I couldn't fathom it. So, you know, a lot of the time when I'm scared, I act with bravado. I think everybody does, actually. Bravado is a cover for insecurities. And I went round to sign this contract and the paparazzi were there and it was the record company and an inking of a contract. And I thought to myself, all that's missing is like a giant check from the lottery. You know, yeah. There's 80 million quid on it, me going like that. And I think my memory is that the paparazzi were like, "Give us a quote, Robbie, give us a quote." Now, there's a lady that in 1979 or 1980 won the pools, and she won a million or so, and it was a big win, the biggest win. And she was asked what she was going to do with the money, and she said, "I'm going to spend, spend, spend." I thought she said, "I'm rich beyond my wildest dream," which is what came out of my mouth, thinking that people will understand that I'm aping this lady. And erroneously, that's what I said. And then it stuck with me. And then I used to have this flat on the 15th floor in Chelsea Harbour. And the windows and the curtains were closed one day. And I just woke up with something happening outside. I'm like, "Hey, I'm on the 15th floor." And then I heard, "I'm rich beyond my wildest dreams." And I went to open the curtain and it was a window cleaner on one of those things. And it was just like...
Did he know it was you then in behind the curtains?
Yeah, but he didn't know that I was actually in bed listening to what he said. So I know that it went into the public as one of those moments where I said one of those things.
So I got to ask, do you actually own a private island?
No, I don't own a private island. No.
You live down the road from Britney, didn't you? When all the, I mean, the paparazzi stuff you were touching on before, that was when it was at its maddest, wasn't it?
Yeah, I used to go past, like, outside of mine, we both lived on gated communities, and outside of mine, there was like several famous people, you know, in mine: Charlie Sheen, Tom Jones, Paris Hilton, Christina Aguilera, Shaquille O'Neal, and so on and so forth, and other people, you know. And so there would be six as you would turn out of the gates just waiting for one of us, and so it would be. But then you go past Britney's and there'd be the gates and the road and then a rough piece of land, and on that rough piece of land there'd be anything between 10 to 20 cars just waiting for her. I know what those moments felt like for me, and I know how unbearable they were. I could only imagine what that kind of scrutiny must have felt like.
Did you meet Brittany?
Brittany lived in another gay community. Yeah, I met several of those neighbours and we got on perfectly fine. Actually, Slash used to live across the road from me. And there was like, it's Slash. And there was one day I saw him and, you know, he spent some time in Stoke-on-Trent. He came from Stoke-on-Trent, weirdly enough. And like, I'm from Stoke and I'm Slash and me. And it was one of those moments where you rise above yourself and you like, just notice what's happening. I'm sort of leaning against his wall and he's leaning against his wall. And we're moaning about the housing association. And I'm like, I just was like, you are with Slash in Los Angeles moaning about the housing association. What is your life? This is mental.
I heard you speaking recently about having lots of people working in your house and how strange that is to wake up and, like, you know, it's not your family, they're people working there.
Yeah, we had a rather large house in Beverly Hills. And, yeah, because you make a bit of money and then you wonder what you do with it. And then you can give it to these people that are supposed to grow your money for you. And then after a while you go, I don't trust these people. I don't think they're bothered. What should we do? And then you think, well, I'll put it in bricks and mortar, because if you put it in bricks and mortar, if the arse falls out of the world, at least you'll have walls to live in. So I bought this massive place in Beverly Hills. And what I didn't understand in my naivety was what it takes to run something like that. And what it does take to run something like that. It's like having a mega yacht, but on land. And, you know, I won't go, but I'd come down and I'd look through the kitchen window and there'd be 11 cars in the car park and none of them would be ours. And they'd be everybody that works at the house. And I never had the opportunity to completely relax into my newfound surroundings, because ultimately I'm from Stoke-on-Trent and I know that 11 cars in the car park that work at your house isn't right. And because every one of those cars is costing you money. So you living in this house is costing you money. And yeah, we solved that.
Do you go back to Stoke-on-Trent? Have you ever, for example, done a talk at your high school or gone a high school reunion, anything like that?
I was there yesterday. I was at Port Vale and I was doing an interview for Apple Music yesterday. And I've started going back to Port Vale because the chairperson is a wonderful lady. She's absolute magic. Her name's Carol, and I think that my football club has got the best chairperson, man or woman, that could be available. And she's just intoxicating as a person. You just want to be around her because she emanates positivity and safety and kindness, and she's doing an awful lot for charity. So I'm back in the fold. I'm at Port Vale when I can get to Port Vale. And I'm in Stoke when I can be in Stoke.
Would you ever buy one of the clubs like Ryan Reynolds bought Wrexham, didn't he?
I can't afford a football club. You know, it's like if it was my only thing, I could afford a football club, but it's not my only thing. You know, the outgoings, it's a hefty hobby to have. And I wonder what's in it for them. You know, is there 10 million from Amazon or Netflix for the documentary? What is it that, you know, they're, because, you know, they're very, very busy people and they live in another side of the world and they have families of their own. Why are they getting on a plane and coming to Wales? I'm not knocking it, because I think it's beautiful and I think it's wonderful. And, you know, I have total admiration for both of those two people. And Ryan Reynolds, I absolutely love, you know, it's like I've got a massive talent crush on him. But if I can figure out why they're doing it, then maybe I'll do it too.
Well, that's what I wanted to talk about, your upcoming deal with Netflix on your docuseries. Are we able to talk about that?
Yeah. I don't know what it is yet. I know it's a 4-hour documentary. It's four episodes. I had a meeting with the director last week, and we passionately want to break form with whatever's happened with other documentaries, because, you know, I'm not interested or excited about archive footage and a talking head interview, because, you know, it's boring and it's been done to death. I'd like the form to be different. And I don't think you can have a 4-hour documentary about me and just have it be archive footage and chatting. I think that would bore people. And the last thing that I want to do with anything that I do is to bore people. I want them to be entertained. And I want them to felt good about investing that time wondering about me.
What do you think of the death of Amy Winehouse? And what advice do you give to young people who are battling demons and have got addiction issues? Because I think it's important. You know, your story is so inspirational. You've gone through the hellfire and you've become hugely successful. What are the tools you could pass down to young people who are suffering in this day and age?
Well, I'm at the other side of the tunnel. I can go back into that tunnel whenever I so choose. You know, you're never fully recovered or safe. But I can tell people there is peace and there is a safety and there is a modicum of trust that you can have in yourself. And there is a reason to live and persevere. Unfortunately, when you are dealing with addictions and when you are dealing with the mental illnesses attached to them, like depression and anxiety and whatever, it takes an awful long time to come out the other end. But you didn't get there in a day. You know, I was told this, that, you know, what happens is one day a brick appears and then next day two bricks appears. And so on and so forth, before you know it, you're under this massive castle or incredibly huge wall that you've built for yourself, and it's impossible to get out, especially in a day. That's just not possible. I would just say simply, there is a reason to live, and there is a reason to live sober, and there is so much to do and so much to be achieved. And, you know, you have so much less to worry about when you're out of your addiction and being a functioning, I wouldn't say fully functioning, human being. I would suggest that you take the help that is given to you. You listen to the people that love you. I see some people out and about that, you know, won't be helped. And that's tragic. I, for one, didn't want to be in any pain anymore. I wanted to be out of that pain, and I wanted to learn and understand why I was doing this to myself and how it could end. I didn't know the journey was going to be so laborious and trudging through bleak soup and all of that stuff. But, you know, life is fucking good, and I do find joy in things, and I do get excited, and I do have purpose, and you all can achieve that. You know, it's like, I know that I live in rarefied conditions where a lot is afforded to me that isn't afforded to a lot of folks, but it doesn't matter. You know, I've seen people in and around the rooms that help people to get well, that are existing above and beyond their wildest dreams and getting to achieve things that they never thought would be possible. It is possible to be well. It is possible to love and be loved. And it is possible to be looking forward to things and knowing that you'll turn up for them and be the best version of yourself that you can be. It genuinely is a beautiful thing. But it takes fucking time, and Jesus Christ, it takes so long. With some people, it doesn't, though. And you might be that person, whoever it is that I'm talking to down this YouTube channel.
Speaking of what you're talking about now, aptly titled Better Man biopic, how involved are you in that?
I'm very involved. Michael Gracie, that helmed The Greatest Showman, it was a huge movie, massive success, is a mate of mine and asked me if he could do a biopic about me. And yeah, of course you can, wow. Michael Gracie. Yeah. And I sat down and I told him my stories. And I told him my stories for 12 hours. So the whole script is in my words and is my voice. But down to who is cast in whatever roles, it's my music. It's my music, it's my words.
John O'Davies is you.
Yeah, John O'Davies is me, doing a great job as me.
I can't wait to see that.
Yeah, I've seen some of the rushes, and there's quite a big idea for the film. Once again, it breaks with type, and it's not your usual, you know. It's got every opportunity to be a success, and for somebody that doesn't like anything that they've ever done, it takes a lot for me to say that.
So does it not scare you bringing your children into the public eye?
They're in the public eye whether they want to be or not.
Does it scare you?
Yeah, absolutely terrifies me. From 16, the press are allowed to do whatever they want with them. You know, at the moment in this country, in the UK, they're not allowed to show their faces. But after they become 16, they're public property. And it's difficult to know what to do. Especially, as I've mentioned, Teddy before, she's my 10-year-old that just wants to be a performer. And there are moments that I really want to have with her. You know, I want that moment where I'm on stage with her, singing with her and having that daddy-daughter moment. And I get to show the world this beautiful creature that I'm incredibly proud of. And she gets to... You know, it is difficult to know what to do. Do you introduce her to this because this is what you're going to do? Do you get used to it? I don't know. Every day's a school day. At the minute, you know, their privacy is ensured, at least in the UK. But then they become other. That being said, I love their mom, and their home life is incredible and loving and safe. And if I could choose to be anyone, I'd choose to be any one of my children. They have the best life. but yeah, it is a conundrum. Obviously, I never want them to have the internet. I never want them to be able to read any comments about themselves. I know what damage that does. I know what online trolling has done to me and my psyche. And it pains me to think that they would ever inhabit anything that feels like that.
What about the classmates? Do they get treated differently at school?
No, because they're in posh school. It's like, you know...
even there, there's a hierarchy, though, isn't there?
Dude, yeah. We're the poorest at school. It's not Witness or Stoke-on-Trent. Honestly, we're the poor relations. Believe me.
Are there other sort of celebrity parents? Are you at parents' evening and there's like, you know, I can't think of an English celebrity right now, but you know what I mean.
No, well, at the moment they're homeschooled, but they do have a school that they go to when they're in Los Angeles, and there are different places where they can find being social and having a semi-school life. But whenever they're there, it's like, you know, P. Diddy's the dad of the one above, and you know, it's all that stuff. It's like financially I pale into insignificance when it comes to these big hitters that have got the kids at the schools that my kids frequent.
When you were living in LA, did you sort of was it natural to sort of group together with other Brits out there? Did you know David Beckham? Did you cross over with him?
My house is basically the Isle of Wight in the middle of Beverly Hills. It's just British people, and then my wife and my mother-in-law and her boyfriend. Oh yeah, and my mother-in-law, my brother-in-law, everybody else is British. Everybody.
Can we talk about your podcast At Home with the Williamses? I can't say it. Yeah. Sorry. Right. Yeah, you haven't posted on a while, but you did it through lockdown.
Yeah, we did it. I had a Christmas album out, and it was a way to promote the Christmas album. And me and my wife got to work together, and we basically had domestics in the confines of the safety that neither of us could take it too far because it was all being recorded. That wasn't the basis of the podcast, but that's what it actually turned into. Remember when you did that and I didn't like it? Remember when you did that and I hated it? Yeah, I remember it. but that's the thing is about your line of work and what you're doing, which is something that I'd really love to do, but I don't have the time to be persistent and also create that content week after week, day after day. It's a full-time job. You guys have a full-time job. I also have a full-time job. And as much as I would like to think that I would be a good YouTuber or a good podcaster, I don't have the time right now.
Is there anything else you aspire to be outside of music?
Yeah, I think I was mentioning before, I've written a TV show, a dark comedy. I'd like that to be a success. I've got this idea for a talent show. I'd like that to be a success.
So what's your story arc for your dark comedy?
I don't want to give it away, but it's good. It's really, really, really good.
Is it based in Stoke?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Great. Wow. Makes me think of that. Steve Merchant recently had one back in Bristol, which is where I am now, and it had that real feel to it.
Well, we're almost at 2 hours, Rob. You've been very generous with your time. I'm not going to push it here. If you've got any final stuff you'd like to say to the viewers?
No, because I've got to watch Married at First Sight. Is anybody else watching?
Oh,
Married?
I love that. Sean wouldn't have a clue. I love it.
Are you up to date?
No spoilers, please, because I'm not going to come away for a few days. Is it getting brutal?
Yeah, it's just a classic season. It's very, very good TV.
You're not watching Jeffrey Dahmer then?
My drummer's watching the Jeffrey Dahmer thing, and I don't want to go to bed with that. That's not...
No.
Oh, it's dark.
No.
I'm currently away from the house rehearsing up in Birmingham, and I would rather go to bed on conflict designed by a reality TV show for people that have just gotten married, that have never met around a dinner table, that are too drunk, than actually watch anything to do with Jeffrey Dahmer before I go.
Amen.
Well, huge thank you, Rob. You know, it's been an absolute blast. If there's anything we can ever do for you, you just please let us know. And you enjoy.
Well, let's keep in contact, because you know I'd like to maybe come on and be a host with you.
Yes.
Can I?
No. Warrington people, they were our mortal enemies in Widnes. We were the chemical manufacturing town. They were the wire manufacturing town. So it was the chemics versus the wires. And at the rugby league matches, there'd be standing Braveheart-style battles, and the police had set the dogs on us and everything.
Yeah. Well, I was with all the rugby lads from Warrington, the ones that used to go and watch the rugby. That's why I was safe at the nightclubs. Yeah. Was it Mr. Smith's too though?
Yeah, the Hitman and Her came out of Mr. Smith's, and there was Legends as well. It was a rave club out of Warrington. Did you ever get to that one?
No, I didn't. Did you ever go to Quadrant Park?
Oh, Quadrant Park was like my mecca after it was the state earlier on in Liverpool. They shut that down. Everyone started to go to Quadrant Park, and yeah, I had some good nights in the quad.
Yeah. And you went to Cream, right?
No, because I went to America in 91.
Oh, whereabouts in America did you go to?
I was in Phoenix, Arizona for about 16, 17 years.
Oh, right. You went straight to Phoenix. I know your story, obviously, but I couldn't remember where you went to. Phoenix.
Did you gig in Phoenix?
No. I probably, but I can't remember. It was 25 years ago.
Beautiful place. Grand Canyon. You could see all the stars and everything. Oh, it's, yeah.
I've rehabbed in Arizona, so I'm.
Oh, in Tucson.
Yeah.
My girlfriend, who got me to shoot up heroin with her, she ended up in that exact same rehab,
Cottonwood or whatever it is.
And she told me about it, and I bought shares in it, and they went up 500%.
Yeah, that's another story. Rehabs and profitable rehabs.
Next so, Health, I think, was it, the company that owned it.
Right. Oh, wow. So, Jen, did you get broken into or something the other day?
I did, yes. Yeah. Somebody broke my bedroom window. Very
late.
That's scary. Yes, yeah. It's pretty. That's why I'm currently away at the moment. I'm not at my home. So I'm coming away to stay with friends.
Is that something to do with something that you've said, or is that just a random thing?
No, we think it's, yes. I don't think it's anything to do with the YouTube world.
That's good. Yeah, what's your story, Jen?
What's my story?
Yeah.
What would you like to know?
No, how did you end up doing this?
Oh, coming on the podcast with Sean. It started off with me getting to wear one of my hoodies because I've got an organic cotton clothing company business. And then we became really good friends. And then it was August last year he came and asked me, and I was up for the challenge. So
you've never done anything like this before?
No, and I've got my lucky knickers on tonight, what I wore on my first interview.
I'm very proud that I must be the jubilee for your lucky knickers.
You've been my favourite.
And Andrew, what's your story?
So I sort of grew up idolising Louis Theroux. So I started making documentaries for the BBC and HBO, where I'd be on screen. And my sort of big hitter was one about exorcism in Argentina. It's on YouTube or iPlayer.
I think I've seen it. So what did you make of the whole exorcism?
So the amazing thing was, because I'm an atheist personally, but also I'm really open-minded to whatever, you know, whatever I see. And the people who got exorcised, there were three different women that we exorcised, and they all got much better because they had things like schizophrenia, bulimia, various mental health, intrusive thoughts like you were speaking about before. That was a big one. So these are all things, you know, that we think of as psychological, but they thought of as demons inside them, and this priest was exorcising. So they got better, but I went back to Buenos Aires a year later and they were sort of back to the beginning again, which to me implies it was a bit of a placebo suggestion thing. Also, the exorcist was really abusive, and he sort of locked me in this room at the end and started screaming at me, and I thought he was going to kill me.
Why did he do that?
Because I was asking questions about his relations with one of the women, because he was getting very close with her, and she was like 18 and he was like, you know, 60 odd, and he wasn't supposed to be like kissing her, and he was living upstairs with her. So I was asking a few questions, and a few of the clergy were a bit jealous, and they were like whispering things to me like, well, he's a bit close with her, that kind of thing. And I got a bit stupid because I didn't think about, even though they're bitching to me, I didn't think about how they were going to then tell him what I said. So there was this moment when he had this big mass. He's quite a famous guy out there. He had tens of thousands of people. It's the middle of nowhere in Buenos Aires at midnight. And we go in, me and my director, it's just me and my mate David, basically. We go in expecting to film the big mass full of exorcisms. And then suddenly someone says, Andrew, can you just come backstage? So there's like people like frothing at the mouth in this mass. They're all like falling over each other. He's got the music from The Exorcist, tubular bells playing in the mass in the church and in the nave. And I go backstage and he's there, The Exorcist, and he's going, you've interviewed me, I'm now going to interview you. Just come in here a minute. And he wouldn't let my cameraman in. And he had a few big blokes with that thing from Jafar from Aladdin, the staff. They've all got that, and they were sort of hovering over me. And for about an hour, just screaming at me, pushing me around this room. And my director's trying to open the door, and they're slamming it shut. And the guy's just screaming and screaming and screaming. And he's going, why are you asking people about me giving mouth kisses to this girl? And I was like, I didn't. Well, I did, but I didn't mean it like that. And he's going, well, you... And all this stuff. And eventually they did just... Let us go. And as we're leaving, I can hear him in the mass of thousands of people, and he's going, the devil is in here tonight, and the Falklands, they took the Falklands, because we're British obviously in Argentina. Just mad stuff. But yeah, we got away eventually.
Wow, how terrifying.
It was. I was shaken.
And are you from London or are you from Bristol?
I'm from Watford, just outside London.
Are you any relation to Raz Gold?
No, I don't know who that is.
Oh, right, okay. My, you're Jewish, right?
Yeah.
My wife's Ashkenazi Jewish.
Oh, really?
He's a Cohen, yeah.
I bet our families know each other.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's nice.
So by in turn, our kids are Jewish too, right? Because the wife is.
That's right. That's right. Do they know they're Jewish?
I believe in passing they do. Yeah.
It's an interesting thing because it's no one knows if it's an ethnicity, a culture, or a religion. You can be an atheist Jew, of course. And I was reading Christopher Hitchens talking about he found out after his mum committed suicide that she had been Jewish and kept it from them because they were scared of anti-Semitism. And he said it just changed his whole view. He was like 50 years old by this point. It changed his whole view of his life. And he was very happy to hear it, he said, but it's a strange thing to find out.
Yeah, I think I became atheist for 10 minutes because I did my research.
Yeah.
But I believe in something. I don't know what that something is. I'm not fully atheist. I'm a C+ theist.
Yeah. You believe in angels, one might say.
I do.
I mean, that is a good point, isn't it? That is a religious song, isn't it? People don't, is it?
It is a religious song, yeah. Now, whether they exist or not, who knows? But I like my belief in Archangel Michael and Archangel Gabriel, and that song's about actual angels. Whether it's fantasy or not, I care not. They exist in my mind.
This podcast is sponsored by Gadfly Press. We are proud to announce the publication of Britain's number one art forger, Max Brandert, The Life of a Cheeky Faker. And from the back cover blurb, Max the Forger is an artist and gentleman whose colourful lifestyle has spanned over 70 years. He has lived under the strict regime of Bernardo's Children's Homes, been an elephant handler in the circus, lived rough, busked his way from Brighton to Bombay, sold his fakes up and down the country, dined with dukes, socialised with celebrities, associated with gangsters, served time in prison, and donated tens of thousands to charity. And through it all, he has never stopped smiling and loving life and missing his mum. Quote from the book. Mr. Brandert, I do not see you as a malicious criminal, sighed the judge. But why, oh why, do you continue to use your God-given talent in this way? I just can't help myself, Your Honour. It's like an addiction, I grinned. Available worldwide on Amazon. Link in the description box below this video. Thank you for supporting our sponsor.